This is the oral history from Paul Kosin, taken on July 29th, 2010.
Can you state your name, birthday, and hometown?
Paul Jeffrey Kosin. My hometown is Syosset, New York, and my birthday, May 6th, 1955.
Where did you study meteorology?
I went to school both at Cornell University and Penn State University.
How and when did you become interested in weather?
Oh, I was a kid with very many interests, going one to the next, to the next, to the next. And I just happened to be interested in the weather at a very impressionable age of around 11, and it stuck.
Is there any particular reason?
Well, there was. We were in Mexico with my parents, as I remember. And I remember finding out it was like 42 degrees in New York, and I said, wow, that's really cold. And it just was really interesting. Then I found out, no, that was in Celsius. Oh, what is that? So it was like 107. Like, oh, that's really hot. I just thought that was very fascinating at the time. So I was just getting into the weather, and that kind of like I thought was cool. Anyway, the real bigger answer, I got interested in the weather because I grew up in the suburbs of New York, and we had all these huge snowstorms back in the late 1950s and early 1960s. So what's not to like?
All right. How long have you been with the Weather Service?
Well, I have dual careers with the Weather Service. I was with the Weather Service from 1989 through 1998, and I've been with them now again from 2007 to the present.
Can you tell me a little bit about your career as a meteorologist?
I probably could tell you something about my career. My career began in 1979 following graduate school. I became a contractor for the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, met a fellow by the name of Louis Uccellini, who was an up-and-coming scientist, and he asked me if I was interested in snowstorms, so I just answered, yes! So we started collaborating. So we first worked at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. He then went over to what was then the National Meteorological Center. I followed soon after, and I worked from at NMC, now known as NSEP, from the years of 1989 and 1998. Then I went to the Weather Channel right at the turn of beginning of 1999. I worked there through 2006, and then I came back to NSEP in 2007.
All right, so now we're going to move on and talk specifically about surface analysis.
I've heard of that.
So, to start with, can you please give me a definition of surface weather analysis?
Ooh, surface weather analysis is taking many, many, many observations, probably the largest data set that we actually have to use in the weather service. And we apply techniques we've learned over many years in school and then through personal experience to analyze all sorts of phenomena according to the latest scientific principles.
Okay. What features are typically included on a surface weather map?
Well, the standard features are high and low pressure centers, cold fronts, warm fronts, occlusions. We can also put mesoscale boundaries, outflow boundaries, convective complexes, sea breeze fronts. We can put any number of phenomena.
Why do you think surface analysis is important to the field?
Good question. I personally think that surface analysis is important to the field because, number one, we live at the Earth's surface, and every single model forecast we do involves interpretation of what eventually is a surface weather analysis. So if you're looking at a numerical weather forecast, the best way of knowing what you're looking at is having experience doing surface weather analysis so you can predict what you actually can diagnose by doing it yourself.
All right.
Something like that.
Who are the main users of the surface weather analysis?
Well, I would say all meteorologists involved in forecasting should be using surface weather analyses. Students, weather enthusiasts, the media, of course, anytime you see a weather map on television, those are typically surface analyses. The ones you see in the newspaper, the ones you see on the internet, they're all typically surface analyses.
Okay. And do you use use these charts, and what do you use them for?
Personally, I use these charts to get the best idea I know of what actually is going on. If I don't get my fix of doing a surface weather map, I feel like sort of like one arm is missing. I can tell you sort of what's going on, but I can't give you a real idea of what's happening without having done my own surface analysis.
All right.
How
has surface analysis changed since you started working that desk?
Oh boy. Well, I started at NMC back in the late 1980s and early 90s, and surface analyses were done what I'd call in not a particularly modern fashion. We used acetates to trace maps and to then redraw them, retrace them, redraw them again, and retrace them, and eventually scan them in some fashion to get them out to the public. During the following years, I actually helped in designing or setting the specifications for updating surface analysis from this antiquated technique to one where it's done on workstations. And I guess the point of using me in that analysis is, since I'm such a stickler for detail, I would be very difficult. It would be hard for me to reconcile a system that I felt wasn't as good as doing it by hand. So that's why I helped set the requirements, so we could do a variety of things like redraw fronts, cut them in little corners, cut and paste, change the names of the fronts, being able to flip them back and forth in case you entered it the wrong way, and just basically to help create a system that replicated as best we could the best we could do by hand. It took a long time to go from acetates to workstations, because anytime you impose a change where people are used to doing it a certain way, where it has obvious advantages, to the unknown, create a lot of friction. And again, I think part of why I was chosen to help set the requirements was I was, in fact, a real stickler. It's like, you know, you better damn make it good, or else, you know, I'm going to give you a hard time, because, you know, if we can't do it like I'm used to doing it, you know, I don't want to change. So I was sort of one of the biggest skeptics that had to be, number one, not only shown what to do, but be part of the process in recommending, like, can we redraw that? Can we do something like that? Is it something that's something more we can, resembles like doing it by hand? I think there would be a lot less resistance to having it come by. So it was a lot of trial and error. One thing that actually did surprise me is that we worked on this back, I guess it was back in the early 1990s, and I was away from the Weather Service for like 7 or 8 years, and I basically came back to like, well, how did it change? How has it changed? Well, it actually hasn't changed all that much, meaning that we must have done something okay to make the system, you know, there didn't seem to be a lot of resistance to the workstation once it came about. I think there was an incredible amount of like, I don't know about this, but when it was actually used, I don't think it met as much resistance as we expected. So that process probably took a couple of years. We first did it on what was called this Intergraph workstation. We first started it using daily weather map rather than go strict start on the operation, because we have a lot more time with that. And the first thing there was that, you know, can we just produce a quality map? And the answer was absolutely. You know, we can change things, we can set it up in such a way that it all can be done electronically. So the next test was whether or not we could actually do it in real time. That was a much bigger test. But it turns out that, yeah, I think as we can see now, we had those same time limits back then, but a lot of that time was spent drawing on one acetate, tracing it over, then cleaning the acetate, drawing it again, then transferring it. It was just a mess. You know, it was kind of like doing things in the dinosaur ages. So we knew it had to go that way. We just had to make sure that it was going to go in a way that was, you know, going to work. So I think it worked.
So what are the pros and cons of using the workstations?
Okay, the pros and cons of workstations. The pro, obviously, is potentially all the data's there. It's done efficiently, automatically. It's non-repetitively. You do it once, that's it. You don't have to transfer it back and forth. Some of the problems with workstations are that they don't quite resemble what's actually the skill of looking at data and drawing it by hand. So there are a few trade-offs, but I think the trade-offs are actually kind of worthwhile, saving the time and space and being able to get the quality you want, I think are important qualities.
All right. After the observations come in, what is your procedure for creating a surface map?
Ooh. Okay, my procedures for creating a surface map are all dependent on how much time I have. So typically, if we're doing like the North American surface analyses, I almost instantly, when I see the data start going to work, I'll look at the last analysis. I will start drawing in my own lines just to get an idea before the objective analysis comes in that I have already a basis of what's coming up. Eventually, the objective analysis comes in. Once that does, and I've got the data and the objective analysis there and all the underlying fields, I can go to work. Adjusting, manipulating, checking, looking at time series of data to be able to check whether or not features have moved through or not. It's just a very iterative process going back and forth, really getting the best sense of what actually is going on. So given the hour and a half that we're working on it, I've always felt that it's just enough time.
All right. Now, a couple of questions to put you on the spot. How do you find a cold front?
How do I find a cold front? Well, it's not all that necessarily clear. Actually, the best way I can find a cold front is to first look at the model forecast and determine where on the models, what information is telling me that there's a enhanced baroclinic zone, the leading edge of which might indicate a cold front. It might also be associated with a change in wind direction, a change of temperature, a change of dew point. Sometimes in the summertime, they're very difficult to find, so continuity becomes a very important part. And some very subtle features, you know, maybe subtle shift in wind or subtle change in dew point might be some indication, but then you have to look at sort of surrounding stations and time series to try to sense if this one feature at one point actually has some consistency with some other features that would define a cold front. So, got your answer.
All right, and then how do you find a warm front?
Warm front, well, it probably works on the same level. I think typically cold fronts are, at least in the wintertime, are a little more distinguishable, while warm fronts can be a little more subtle in terms of where they're located, but I think the principles are basically the same.
Sorry.
Are there ever differences in opinion on frontal structure and placement?
Differences of opinions on where we place frontal structures. We have difference of opinions all the time. Some people are just plain wrong, and other people have some very valid points, and sometimes it's not all that clear when a lot of these boundaries are actually not very well resolved. So, you know, distinguishing between a wind shift that's accompanied by no temperature change, or you're looking at the model forecast and it's located, say, in a warm ridge, as opposed to looking at the leading edge of a baroclinic zone where there may actually be a subtle wind shift, there are subtleties that require I think an incredible amount of experience to validate.
Okay. All right. How have about differences in opinions about including mesoscale features or tropical features?
Well, we have within our National Weather Service, at least within HPC, we have a set of rules. And those rules determine which kinds of features you can include and which kinds are not. If we were to include every sea breeze front that occurred every day, we would be drawing the same front in the same location, say over the West Coast, all the time. So we make choices about which features we do. A lot of it has to do with saving time. A lot of it has to do with if they're just sort of topographical features that show up every day, then there's probably less reason to use it. As far as mesoscale boundaries go, sometimes they are much more important than the larger scale features, especially in the summertime where you can have a cold front that doesn't really look like a cold front, but everything is developing actually along these little mesoscale boundaries or outflow boundaries from thunderstorms that actually reflect better where the edges, leading edges of temperature gradients are going to be located, which is also where the active weather is going to be. So it sometimes gets very complicated, like, is that an outflow boundary? Is that a squall line? Is that a supercell? Or some other phenomenon. Is it, in the wintertime, it could do the same thing. Is it radiation fog? Is the temperature difference due to clouds versus clear skies? There are so many elements that come into it that, you know, all of it's actually important, but you have to use some discretion in terms of, like, what's a real boundary and what's not.
All right. When coordinating with other offices for the unified surface analysis, what are some of the more common debates?
Some of the more common debates are locations of fronts over the tropics, so that would be something we often need to coordinate with the Tropical Prediction Center. And especially over the oceans, I'm going to say it. we coordinate when we have features that actually look like satellite images of upper level features, but don't actually look like what they'd be at the surface. So we've got to coordinate and try to have it actually. I'm a big believer in the models. The models aren't always correct, but the models have come to a point where they look pretty darn good. I'm a big believer in, like, well, if it looks kind of like the models, prove to me that it actually is not really looking like the models. And a lot of times I think the models do great, so I think it'll involve interpretation over the oceans especially.
Okay. All right. What do you see as the next step in technology for surface analysis?
Actually, I think the next step in technology for surface analysis is probably a little bit controversial. I think and this is something I never used to believe because I never thought that the models had gotten to a point where we're really reproducing features accurately, and especially the small scale features that that really drive some of the more interesting weather. I think technology might be at a point where we have very little interaction in terms of producing the surface analyses, perhaps in changing fronts, but that much of it can be done sort of automatically. And at times, there needs to be somebody who basically checks it, because at times there will be rapidly developing small-scale phenomena that the models are not going to pick up. So we would still edit it at that point. So, I mean, the goal ultimately is no surprise, no nothing. Everything could be done automatically, and it looks fabulous.
All right.
Fabulous.
Okay, what do you think about changes maybe for the future in the use of the actual surface analysis?
I'm actually hoping that there will be a change back to the way things used to be, because I think surface analysis is kind of a lost art. It used to be such a primary means of making forecasts before the advent of all these computer models that I think reliance on the models alone, after I just said what I think I did, that a lot of meteorologists rely only on the models and lose sight of actually looking at the data. Now, until models really do become close to being perfect, which they're not, over-reliance, I think, on the models and just not actually looking at the relationship between the surface data, the radar data, satellite data, looking at changes over time, I think meteorologists lose a lot of perspective on what's going on. Those really small, subtle changes that actually have important ramifications on the weather. So I hope there's actually a little more attention focused, placed back on surface analysis, doing it and looking at it, that has sort of been lost over the last 20 years. And actually, I think there has been a little bit of resurgence, certainly at NSEP. Louis has actually done quite a bit to keep surface analysis as very much a part of the forecast process.